It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Welcome to Dig, a history podcast.
On the last day of a hot and incredibly dry June, four criminals appeared bound before the bench of London's primary criminal court, the Old Bailey. The year was 1714. Robert and Margate Cook, Thomas Davis, and Deborah Stent were facing burglary charges. The team allegedly pulled off a pewter heist in the house of Mary Mellors the month before.
A pewter heist.
Very high stakes. Robert Cook made the mistake of bragging about the crime, while Margate and Deborah were caught selling off the pewterware for cash. The stakes were high. The punishment for burglary in early modern London was death.
Without much fanfare, Robert Cook and his sidekick, Thomas Davis, were found guilty and sentenced to death. But Cook's wife, Margate, and her friend Deborah Stent were acquitted, not because of insufficient evidence or because of mitigating circumstances, but by reason of their coverture. The doctrine of coverture deprived married women of legal status, merging her legal personhood with her husband's. This magical get-out-of-jail-free card, or judicial prejudice, as legal scholars might say, preserved thousands of English women from the gallows ever since the Norman conquest of England in the 11th century. But this loophole in the patriarchy wasn't all fun and games. Today, we'll get into the complex ways that the doctrine of coverture shaped the lives of married women in the British Isles from the 11th to the 19th centuries. So, you know, just covering a tiny
long,
bit of ground.
Yeah, long durée.
I'm Sarah.
And I'm Marissa.
And we are your historians for this episode of Dig. Coverture was one of many legal concepts that made up English common law. People throw that concept around sometimes, but few people know exactly what it means. We often call couples common law husband and wife. Common law in general, and English common law in particular, is a customary body of laws. That is, law that is a widespread traditional practice, but not necessarily written as a statute or codified into civil law. So basically, it's just law because people think that it's law.
I feel like there's plenty of analogies that we can use here for that.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, my favorite one is because I took a history of papermaking class. And,
oh, wow.
And I had to write this big paper on papermaking for paper money.
Weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, what an oddly specific class.
Yeah,
Niagara University, I'll do it. Our paper money in the U.S., it's not backed by precious metals.
Yeah, not anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
So it only has worth because we invest it with value simply by all agreeing that it's valuable.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Coverture was much like this. 17th century jurists liked to use the analogy of a stream. In the 1632 juridical text, the Laws Resolutions of Women's Rights, or the Laws Provision for Women, they spelled women,
woman,
because they they come from them. Mm. Quote, when a small brook or little river incorporateth with the Rhone or the Thames, the poor rivulet, which I think is
rivulet.
Well, they just spelled it stupidly then.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they spelled
revolt.
They spelled it revolt, but they probably is rivulet. Spelling was, they weren't that into Loseth her name. So this little river loseth her name. It's carried and recarried with the new associate. It beareth no sway. It possesseth nothing during coverture. A woman, as soon as she's married, is called covere in Latin nupta, which is veiled. So it means covered or veiled. Mm-hmm. As it were clouded and overshadowed, she hath lost her stream. End quote.
Yeah, common law made sharp distinctions between married women, or femme covere, meaning covered women, and unmarried women, or femme sole, meaning single women. Femme sole was almost always used to describe widows. Single women who were never married were just called virgins or maidens, regardless of whether they were actually virgins or not. Married status was the legal and cultural norm. One Stuart-era jurist referred to all women as either married or to be married.
In theory, bee has two E's, just for fun.
Yeah, and bumblebee married. Okay. In theory, femme souls were temporary and almost aberrant, but in practice, they were common enough.
Right. So in a theoretical kind of way, they were like weird and outcast, but in real life, they existed, a lot of them. Yeah. Right. These French epithets, femme sole and femme couvert, used by medieval and early modern Brits, suggest that coverture has Norman origins. Just as a quick refresher for those of you whose medieval history is kind of rusty, the French Normans, as in from Normandy, so northern France, invaded England under William the Conqueror in 1066. Norman culture quickly blended with the Germanic culture of the Anglo people living in England to create a cultural hybrid. This hybrid culture still operates today, and this is to the dismay of Brits because they like to pretend that they're as far from French as they could possibly be, mm-hmm, and they hate everything French. But actually, they're all like kind of a little bit French.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, James's family came to the British Isles in the Norman invasion.
Oh, I'm sure, mm-hmm, they did.
Yep, they did.
They seem super Norman
but
to me.
The only reason that matters is because they're like, his dad's side of the family doesn't have that like Gaelic background. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, because they're Scottish.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Under the doctrine of coverture, a wife's legal and commercial identity was subsumed under her husband's. He was the primary individual in the relationship and she was a subordinate. A concurrent and competing interpretation of coverture is that under the law, husband and wife are one legal entity. In some cases, these two interpretations worked against each other. In other cases, they operated harmoniously alongside each other.
A small subset of crimes known as mal in se were exempt from the strictures of coverture. That is, women were held accountable to them. The most common mal in se crimes were treason, brothel keeping, and murder. In all other crimes, married women were categorized as unaccountable, just like children, wards, quote, lunatics, by that they mean the mentally ill, mm-hmm, and, quote, idiots, right, by that they mean the intellectually challenged or developmentally delayed. So they weren't held accountable, just like all of those people would not have, mm-hmm, been.
They were incapable of being accountable, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So most of the time, husbands, as the primary and superior member of the marriage, were legally responsible for the crimes of their wives. This can be compared to how supervisors are often held accountable for the mistakes of their employees in the workplace, just today. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Margate Cook and Deborah Stent, whose story we told at the top of the show, benefited from this aspect of coverture, but the benefits of coverture were unquestionably outweighed by its disadvantages.
For example, coverture condemned many women to painful burning deaths under the charge of petty treason. Jeepers creepers. When femme covere killed their husbands, they faced not only murder and hanging, but the aggravated charge of petty treason and the sentence of death by burning. In 1688, Mary Aubrey allegedly murdered her husband with the help of three men. It appears that her husband might have died by accidental suffocation after a night at the pub, but Mary made the mistake of dismembering him. She made the mistake. Oops, I happen to have dismembered my husband. Sorry. She dismembered him and then she disposed of his limbs around London, which was, you know, a bad call.
Right, because if he had died accidentally, they think he really might have, but that maybe she panicked and was like, oh my God, and like cut up his body. Yeah. And it's like, no, you could just like left him there.
Yeah, you could have just chilled out a little bit. Maybe.
Right. At trial, the three men who helped her were acquitted for lack of evidence, but Mary Aubrey was not so lucky. Her punishment summary reads, quote, "The sentence against Mary Aubrey was that she should be carried from thence to the place from whence she came, and thence be drawn to the place of execution, and there be burnt with fire till she is dead," ugh, end quote. Because they had to make sure, they said, she can't just be burned with fire. Like, no, they got to burn her until she's dead.
Right.
It's just, ugh, gross. As far as we know, Mary was burned to death that day, while the men who helped her went home free. They were unpunished. Women were therefore legally vulnerable to suspicion, wrongful convictions, and brutal executions when crimes were perpetrated against their husbands.
Femme Covert were also incredibly vulnerable to spousal abuse. Marital rape, a concept that is unfortunately debated even today, which, you know, makes my head explode with rage, could not be prosecuted. You know, side note, marital rape wasn't a crime in New York State until the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
Sexual violence within marriage was perfectly legal. Husbands were encouraged to employ, quote, lawful and reasonable correction, meaning beatings to a reasonable degree. In 1782, an English judge incorporated the common law idea of the rule of thumb into civic law. The rule of thumb allowed for English men to beat their wives with implements no wider than their thumb. The rule also prohibited men from beating their wives to the point of drawing blood, but protected all other forms of corporal punishment husbands inflicted on their spouses. Women were able to sue for restraining orders against husbands who were known to be excessively cruel, but they were unable to punish their husbands in any way for the bodily harm once it actually happened.
Right. So it's like, it's almost like it's a crime if it almost happens, but then once it actually does happen,
there's nothing that can be done. Right.
And as Mary Aubrey's case illustrated, the woman who was burned for treason, wives who were suspected of injury or murder to their husbands were often charged not only with the violent crime, but also the capital crime of treason. How did it even make sense for husbands to be charged with murder for killing their spouses while wives were charged with murder and treason? I mean, both of them was a death sentence, but one of them is a sort of quick death sentence,
right,
by hanging. And then the other one is a really horrific death sentence that's very gendered, too.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The answer can be found in the systematic patriarchal organization of the state and family in early modern Europe. In the late 16th century and early 17th century, so starting in the late Elizabethan area, kind of through this
era. This over here is the Elizabethan area.
Let's just say 1500s and 1600s. European states began regulating family matters that had traditionally been handled socially or by ecclesiastical courts.
States began to collect vital statistics and to regulate marriage and reproduction. Some examples include the outlawing of clandestine marriage, the strengthening of a father's legal rights over his children, and laws forbidding clandestine pregnancies and growing concerns with infanticide. Growing nation-states took an active interest in social engineering, presumably as a means to increase their authority and presence in everyday lives. For example, in 1666, viewing reproduction as a subject's obligation to his nation, France encouraged marriage and reproduction by offering tax cuts to growing families.
Yeah, which sounds very modern to me.
Yeah, it's very, you know, pronatalist.
Yes, mm-hmm. But in 1666. The state's seizure of control of the family from ecclesiastical courts gave them increasing authority over the everyday lives of their citizens. National paternalistic rhetoric portrayed the nation state as a benevolent father to its citizens, which would be its little children.
Mm-hmm.
This organization was mirrored in the formation of real families who built their authority upon a patriarchal frame using male alliances. So the concept of bon ménagement, I just really like this sort of term. It's devised by a fabulous historian of France, and her name is Julie Hardwick. This whole idea, this is how the French kind of took this idea of the paternalistic state and made it into something that was, like, peopled by the family. So this idea of bon management, it tied the management of the French household to its patriarch and the management of the French state by its monarch. So it's like, oh, the patriarch is just a tiny little monarch.
Uh-huh. And, yeah. Actually, this makes a lot of sense to me because this is the same argument that the historian Stephanie McCurry makes about the plantation South, the pre-Civil War South, that
right.
The concept of mastery, that even men... everyone was the master of their domain. Everyone was the master of their, what's it called? Oh, masters of small worlds. Mm-hmm. They were essentially, like you're saying, the king of their family.
Right.
But then if you kind of expanded that outward, the, once the Confederacy is created, right, the president and the government of the Confederacy is supposed to act like the master of that world.
Right.
And take care of its dependents in the same way that a household would run.
Right. So it has this sort of family structure.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But for the official nation state.
Yeah, with all of the gendered aspects that go within that, like being a father, being a husband, that sort of thing. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Really interesting that that's... you know,
a 17th century French
thing. Yeah, that you see repeated.
Yeah, over and over.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Conditions were much the same in England. Take, for example, the trial of the Earl of Castlehaven in the 1630s. Castlehaven was convicted of rape and sodomy and executed in 1631. Historian of legal culture Cynthia Harrop has argued that his trial records indicate that he was condemned not for evidence of sexual deviance or of breaking the law, but because of the disorderliness of his household. Oh, my God.
Right. The jurors were, like, disgusted.
I would probably be executed. Yeah, I think we'd all be executed.
Same, yeah.
My household is disorderly. English monarch Charles I, like other monarchs in Europe at the time, was deeply invested in the orderliness of the household as a means of ordering the state. He was father to a large family and ruler of a populous country, and he expected this familial hierarchy to be duplicated in every household in England.
Right. So just how we see in France, the same thing happened in England. So Castlehaven's peers were less concerned with his alleged sexual preferences for boys than they were with his favoring of young male servants over his son and his inability to properly control his wife and servants.
Right.
So his servants were like sleeping with one another and they're like, excuse me, you're the patriarch. You're supposed to be laying down the law. How is this allowed?
Right.
And the same thing with, like, his wife bought some things that he didn't want her to buy or something. And so people are like, oh, my God.
He has no control over his wife. Yeah.
They're running roughshod over him, you know?
Right,
yeah. So rather than focusing on his crimes, Castlehaven's trial revolved around the running of his household, which was judged to be disorderly. Castlehaven was executed because he failed to fulfill his duty as a patriarch.
Both the patriarch and the monarch had absolute authority over their subjects, but in return, they were expected to manage their realms well. So the early modern nation-state was regarded as the European family writ large. As the Earl of Castlehaven's trial demonstrates, the state took its patriarchal philosophy very seriously. It was a way of life. And this way of life influenced every legal opinion that was delivered during this time.
Coverture was one of the tools that the British state used to reinforce this patriarchal structure. And this is why, since 1351, when a femme couvert killed her husband, she was guilty of treason as well as murder, because she was disrupting not only the patriarchal organization of her household, but by extension, the patriarchal organization of the state. She had basically murdered the king of her household, thus treason.
That is absolutely fascinating.
I know, it took me a while to get around to that, but that's what I was... I was trying to explain.
You have to see how it all kind of builds together in order to understand that concept of why they would be charged with treason.
They're not just trying to be extra mean. They literally viewed this as treason.
Right. That makes such sense. It's really amazing.
Like, you're shocked that I can make sense.
No, that's not what I mean. I mean that it is the way that it was reasoned out in their minds, makes a lot of sense why they would consider that treason.
Right.
Because it had the potential to undermine the whole shebang, right?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. But at the same time, coverture created a venue for criticism of the patriarch, just like in the case of Castlehaven, where he was criticized for his patriarchal duties or lack thereof, or for the crown. So this allowed people to kind of criticize the crown if he wasn't being a good father to the country. This happened in the case of Charles I, who was dethroned and beheaded in 1649 in the course of the English Civil War. So part of that rhetoric for why that happened was because he wasn't fulfilling his duties as a patriarch.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
This is where the doctrine of coverture was unable to accommodate real life. Sometimes patriarchs, like the Earl of Castlehaven, were not holding up their end of the deal. Occasionally, husbands were wastrels or criminals or poor providers. Sometimes they were effeminate men or, God forbid, sexual deviants or something like that. Mm-hmm. These situations occasioned debate about whether wives should be femme couvert when the entire purpose of her coverture, which is that patriarchal orderliness that I'm talking about, mm-hmm. was being undermined by her husband, who was supposed to be the last word.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. In 16th and 17th century England, this question was debated hotly because of the tensions resulting from the English Reformation. Good Protestant Englishwomen sued for divorce or femme sole status on the grounds that their husbands were recusants, which is what they called Catholics who refused to submit to Henry VIII's Church of England. English jurists argued over whether women in these situations should be able to separate their legal identities from those of their husbands. Ultimately, wives of recusants usually remained femme couvert, but in practice, they were likely allowed much more leeway than ordinary married women. On the bright side, recusants who were married women were generally ineligible for legal penalties, unlike their husbands. So women with Protestant husbands could practice illegal religions openly and face no legal repercussions.
Right, because they weren't legal people, so it didn't uh-huh. really matter what religion they practice. Mm. So it's kind of nice that women had this sort of freedom that men didn't have, sort of, because they didn't have legal status. You know, it's kind of a strange thing. So coverture prevented married women from having recourse over rape and bodily harm, as we mentioned before, but femme couvert also suffered extensively at the hands of property law. Wives could not own property. Even if they came to a marriage with considerable wealth, that wealth belonged to her husband after the vows. This is the way in which a woman was covered or veiled by her husband. That's where the word coverture comes from. Her small stream of resources joined his big manly river of manliness. Her husband could legally sell or dispose of all her belongings without her consent because nothing was actually hers.
Right.
It reminds me of parents who are like, this is my house. You can't, you know, mm-hmm. like mm-hmm. everything you buy is mine. Mm-hmm. Like, reminds me of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Several 13th century English lawyers argued that since wives did not legally own anything, they could not make a valid will. Acts of Parliament under Henry VIII revised this legal issue in 1542. From that point forward, English wives were entitled to make a will, but only with the express permission of their husbands. According to a comprehensive study performed by historian Mary Pryor, English married women became increasingly likely to compose wills between 1558 and 1700.
Obviously, nothing happened about it. Wasn't she just that was where her sample was, and she found that actually tons of women were making wills, even though there was this general belief that they didn't need them.
Right.
Yeah. We suspect that during this time, married women were using will writing as a way to assert their rights despite the hindrance of coverture. In fact, we have evidence that English women were sometimes quite savvy in navigating restrictive property laws. Some women got around this aspect of coverture by transferring property to femme sole within their family. 17th century autobiographer Alice Thornton wrote of transferring her property to her mother, who was a femme sole, she was a widow, mm-hmm. Prior to her marriage so that her assets would not be swallowed up by her husband. Hmm. But in most cases, married women lost every claim to property that they had to their husbands. Mm-hmm.
This transfer of property to men made women vulnerable to rape and violence because predatory men saw marriage as a way to get rich quick. The best example of this is the story of a 15th century Norwich widow named Alice Crome. And we should pause here just to mention that this story comes to us from the book by an excellent historian named Sarah Butler. The death of Alice's husband left her in command of valuable property. This attracted many ambitious male suitors. You might say her milkshake brings all of the boys to the yard.
What? Why are you? No, what? Is it
too
many words?
Oh, no, I was just making weird faces.
Okay. So John Williamson, for example, proposed marriage several times, and Alice continually declined. He couldn't take no for an answer. This is unheard of, right?
Yeah.
For guys? No, I can't even imagine. So he abducted her and held her prisoner for 5 weeks. During this time, he beat her and threatened to murder her if she didn't agree to the marriage. For some reason, I can't imagine why, she still didn't want to marry him, so she continued to decline his proposal. He eventually gave up trying to marry her and tried to coerce her into revealing the whereabouts of the deeds to her land. So he thought, well, this is not working. I'm just going to straight up steal this land. Mm-hmm. But she held fast. He moved her to a more secure location and imprisoned her for a further 18 weeks. He chained her to the wall and administered regular beatings. Ella stubbornly resisted his coercion.
God damn. After months, Williamson hatched a different plan. He approached Alice's mother, claiming to be her new husband. He said that he and Alice wished to sell off the lands in her possession. Alice's mother smelled something fishy, so she deposited the land deeds with the mayor of Norwich for safekeeping and freed Alice from her prison.
It's pronounced Norwich, but...
Oh, it's Norwich, Norwich.
Yeah, I mean, well, no, I mean, it's, I'm just saying. British people, they just make up how to pronounce it.
I know.
It's really annoying.
Usually I can guess how it's the British way of pronouncing it, but...
You said Norwich earlier.
Did I?
I think so, yeah. Oh.
After the ordeal, Williamson moved to confiscate Alice's land under the pretense of a legal marriage. Alice hired a shrewd attorney who coached her in marital law, so she got this marriage annulled by the church and petitioned the court to halt Williamson's actions. Her petition argued that if they had been married, which was evidenced by her annulment, she would not have been able to gift Williamson land because husband and wife are all one person in the law, so a wife may not give her husband during their coverture neither land nor goods.
So basically, Alice was made particularly vulnerable by the concept of coverture because it turned her into a commodity. Men were falling all over themselves trying to make a legal union with her so they could take over ownership of not only her, but of her land. But in court, Alice, who is obviously one badass woke woman, used the second interpretation of coverture, that husband and wife are one legal entity, to destroy Williamson's claim to her land, which was also based on the doctrine of coverture. So are we confused yet?
Right,
I know.
Yeah.
I know. It's dizzying.
The key is to understand that interpretation of laws change over time. Medieval coverture usually defaulted to the interpretation of coverture, which rendered husband as superior and wife as subordinate. So Williamson's actions were motivated by his correct understanding of hundreds of years of marital common law. However, unfortunately for him, the 1400s was a time when medieval attorneys and judges were increasingly likely to interpret coverture as the legal unity of personhood between husband and wife. But both interpretations continued to shape marriage law for the following centuries.
Right. So she just so happened to hit this at the right time when jurists, lawyers, and judges were beginning to interpret coverture in this way.
Right. Yeah.
Right. And before we talk more, I wanted to mention that Alice Crome was really lucky. She had incredibly learned and effective counsel. Mm-hmm. And most women wouldn't have been this lucky and wouldn't have had those resources.
Right.
But she was lucky enough to have them.
Yeah, absolutely.
So for the most part, that's not how it went down.
Right.
But for her story is kind of badass. So so at the risk of muddying the waters, I want to explain a few caveats here. Yes, coverture was extremely powerful and resulted in abuse and loss and grief for women who chose to marry. But not all courts enforced common law. We won't bore you with a rundown of the different English courts and their jurisdictions, but let's suffice it to say that there are a lot and it's complicated.
Mm-hmm.
But the Court of Chancery, for example, mostly ruled in favor of wealthy married women who were seeking to limit their husband's claims on their wealth. So they didn't consider the doctrine of coverture in the rulings. They just didn't.
Mm. Not to mention, common law ran on precedent, but there were so many conflicting precedents throughout various courts and counties that some lawyers and judges, especially those in rural areas where word of new verdicts was slow to arrive, were ignorant of the specificities of coverture. So they just kind of made it up as they went along. So you can see in English court cases involving coverture, this sort of game of telephone going on where the exact meaning of the law just changes over time and space.
We see this with coverture's relationship to business. Under coverture, women were unable to make legal contracts, except for clothing or food, because men, even then, didn't like doing the grocery shopping and clothes shopping. At least that's how it is in my house. But, yeah, so there was these little, you know, well, women domains. Can't make contracts except for food and clothes.
Yeah, because we don't want to bother with
it. Yeah, that's below us. But when Femme Covert did do business, it was in her husband's name. So he, rather than she, was liable for debts and broken contracts. Husbands could be committed to a debtor's prison for debts they didn't even know they'd incurred. But it was just as common for husbands to coerce their wives into transacting shady business deals, knowing they'd get acquitted on account of their coverture. Mm-hmm. So the law could work both ways, in women's favor and against them.
Mm-hmm. This reminds me of something that I actually don't know very much about, but it reminds me of the ways that, like, husbands and wives can't testify against each other in court.
Right.
How that can work in your favor sometimes because, like, you can, like, you know, give evidence to your wife, and then it's like safe because
nobody can ask her about it.
Right.
And we mentioned that in the Elizabeth Brownrigg episode too, that apprentices couldn't give evidence against their masters because mm-hmm. it's the same sort of thing. Like mm-hmm. they weren't married, but they
fell under the same sort of umbrella.
Yeah.
Within the household. In the city of London, custom allowed for married women to be declared femme sole for commercial purposes. Many London merchants' wives ran their businesses while their husbands traveled and brokered deals abroad. The rules of coverture made commercial growth difficult for these families, who were particularly important to the British economy during the early modern period. So London wives were sometimes exempt from the commercial restrictions of coverture. They could negotiate their own contracts, make purchases on credit, and act as legal owner of goods for sale, but all other aspects of coverture still applied to them.
Right.
It's so complicated.
I know. Even if married women were able to obtain femme sole status so they could transact business in their own names, this was not always an advantage. It increased the risk and liability for them, risk and liability that rarely paid off because they were constantly at a disadvantage in the business realm. They often had fewer business contacts, more household responsibilities, and inferior positions to men when they were negotiating business deals. So it's kind of that thing where men are like, well, women are just not as good at business. If they were, they would be better at it. And it's like, well, it's because we're taking care of all of your in the background.
Like actually structural reasons why that is.
Right, exactly.
By the 1690s, married women all over England were beginning to wise up. Educated elite women realized quickly that John Locke's theories of citizenship were not commensurate with the doctrine of coverture. Femme Covert were comparing their plight to that of slaves. The Lady's Dictionary of 1694 reads, quote, "No woman ever gave her plight in marriage with an intent to be a slave." This discontent with the legal ramifications of marriage coincided with a sharp rise in marriage age. It's unlikely that one caused the other, but at a time when marriage was legally restrictive for women, this rise in marriage age afforded women some extra precious years of legal personhood.
So we've talked about this in several other episodes, and most recently in the episode about Elizabeth Brownrigg. So loyal listeners, please forgive me, but I think it bears repeating. The European marriage pattern is integral to understanding the life cycles of early modern women. The European marriage pattern was discovered by statistician John Hodgnall, shows that Northwest European men and women were marrying much later than they had been prior to 1600 and much later in life than men and women in Southern and Eastern Europe. The difference is that in Northwest Europe, families tended to be nuclear, so couples tended to marry later because of the financial burden of having to establish their own household. So families who lived together with extended family, they could get married early on. They didn't need to have mm-hmm. a bedstead, and mm-hmm. they didn't need to buy a house and have to have a mortgage. Like it was,
right.
They didn't have to have all those things, so they could get married before they had built up savings.
Mm-hmm. Though the European marriage pattern has not been definitively explained, most historians acknowledge that economic hardship and vast population growth in the 16th century led to a much later age at first marriage for women in early modern Britain, and a greater likelihood that they would not marry at all. This resulted in a stretch of time when most families were unable to care for their growing daughters, yet these women were unable to marry and establish their own households due to a lack of resources.
The solution for most was going into service. It would be a mistake to refer to domestic service as an exclusively female institution. Most ordinary men, as well as women, experienced a period of service in young adulthood, but its meaning was gendered. For men, this was another step in the ages of man, one when their involvement in the workplace was just beginning. Mm. They would sometimes become apprentices, then journeymen, and then masters. For women, a period of service offered life experience unattached to male relatives, one of both mobility and vulnerability that they may not experience again until widowhood. So this is kind of like a little taste of the femsoul life.
Mm-hmm. Women usually signed annual contracts at most, but stayed in service for many years, obliging them to move from one household or position to another. This increased mobility and autonomy can be interpreted as positive attributes of this stage of life. While in service, women had relative freedom to socialize and use public spaces such as markets. They were able to temporarily escape the surveillance of parents and siblings and to experience financial freedom from their families as their room and board tended to rely on their work rather than on their family relationships. One can easily overstate the extent of these freedoms, however. Some masters fostered paternal relationships with their female servants, taking it upon themselves to police their servants, ensuring their acceptable dress, behavior, and socialization.
Many masters exploited the power imbalance between themselves and their plebeian female servants. The more pessimistic view of this time in an early modern woman's life stresses the vulnerability of an unattached woman in a patriarchal society. Think about her susceptibility to male advances while in service and the dangers of illegitimate birth. In early modern England, rape was legally undifferentiated from seduction, so real female sexual agency was impossible, even at this stage of increased autonomy. The possibility of illegitimate pregnancy was a considerable danger. The historical record is full of anecdotes about masters begetting children on their female servants, the futures of whom depended on his goodwill.
The 1563 Statute of Artificiers gave local officials the right to order unmarried women from the ages of 12 to 40 into domestic service. This policy made sense to a patriarchal society with a growing population of unmarried women. Somewhat ominously, this Act of Parliament specified an age range that coincides with a woman's most fertile years. So most historians regard this policy as an indirect attempt to control the reproduction of single women.
Right. So if you were a single woman of reproductive age and you're supposed to be being a virgin, they're like, oh, let's put them to work and, you know, give them something to do. They'll be less likely to, you know, be bearing bastards or whatever.
Even though their masters were having sex with them and they were having babies anyway.
Yeah, it didn't work.
It was the idea.
The opposite was the case.
Right.
But the idea that was their plan.
Right.
Is kind of interesting. So life cycles for women were more likely to be determined by their sexuality than by their professional and public lives as they were for men. The milestones of courtship, marriage, and motherhood follow the period of service in an early modern woman's life, while marriage and parenthood do not feature as milestones in an early modern man's life at all.
Mm-hmm, right.
His sort of biggest milestones are occupation related.
Mm-hmm.
Like, did they become a part of a guild? Did they mm-hmm. become a journeyman? Did they become a master? Right. Did they retire? Whatever.
Yeah. Just to interrupt you for one second, mm-hmm. and forgive me if you talk about something similar, but there's a really famous etching that was in, like, Harper's Weekly or something in the 19th century that is, like, the life stages of a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And it's exactly what you're talking about. It's, like, she's a little girl, and then she's a little girl, like, she's an older girl at, like, a coming out sort of ball. Mm-hmm. And then it shows her as a newlywed, and then as a young mother, and then as an older mother, and then as a grandmother with little children around her.
Right.
This is all that a woman's life consists of. These
right.
are the major stages of life.
Her relationship to her family.
Yeah.
Yeah. Women started out as daughters in their father's household, so those are virgins. Once again, it doesn't matter if they actually are virgins
right,
or not.
Right, right.
Then moved into a period of service where they were supervised by their masters, and they were still theoretically virgins, but with new fathers. Their master was their new father.
Right.
After the period of service, the vast majority of early modern women then opted for marriage. They became femme covert.
The potential for conflict became even more acute in the world of married women. Marriage was more than just a ceremony between two partners. For women, marriage signaled their matriculation into a new caste, the theoretical, if not actual, transition from virginity to married womanhood. Sexual activity within marriage became expected, and married women played distinct roles in society that were closed to their unmarried counterparts.
Many married women fostered positive homosocial bonds. So by homosocial, I mean with other women. Mm-hmm. So women with other women. Mm-hmm. Examples include the friendly exchange of recipes, the positive female culture surrounding lying in and childbirth, and the dominance of married female voices in local parish politics. So women tended to be really important in parish politics. For centuries, historians scoffed at routine interactions like letter writing, recipe swapping, and the exchange of small gifts. But now we understand them as important bonds between a caste of married women.
Mm-hmm. Married women had prescribed roles in early modern society. They played important roles in negotiating the marriage of others. It might be good to note here that plebeian daughters exercised more autonomy in choosing a partner than actually did their elite counterparts, which it might be counter to what you might imagine.
Yeah, it might be counterintuitive. Anyway.
Elite marriages were always as much business transactions as they were family affairs, so those women were often coerced into marriages that were good for business. The autonomy that women did have was often eclipsed by a vibrant female culture of interference. Mothers, aunts, grandmothers, sisters, cousins, and neighbors, all femme covert, regularly interceded in the courtship negotiations of their loved ones.
These married women considered themselves to be expert mediators between their unmarried relatives and the male world. Their power was considerable, as they were able to influence the outcome of courtship negotiations through direct interventions or indirect social sanctions in the case of their disapproval. So if their young niece or whatever was getting married and they disapproved, they had enough clout in this sort of caste of married women that they could totally tank this courtship. This is another example of a separate female culture that ran parallel to and independently from the male culture of courtship. It's tempting to see these interactions as some kind of secret sisterhood bubbling under the surface. It's an example of how the potential for strong female alliances is actually created by the patriarchal order. So this problem of coverture, there's like sort of benefits this sort of caste of women are incurring.
Mm-hmm. But it's a mistake to see this female culture as a harmonious one, since women sometimes acted as agents against the wishes or best interests of their female relatives. The elevated status of married women could be coercive and injurious to others. Many relationships between married and unmarried women were exploitative. Married women often held their knowledge of sexuality over the heads of their unmarried relatives, and sometimes agreed to surveil the bodies of suspected fallen women, using their supposedly advanced sexual knowledge against single counterparts in defamation suits or in infanticide cases.
Right. So when you hear stories of an infanticide case where they're trying to figure out if someone had just given birth recently, they find an old, woman. They find, Goody Sanders down the street, whatever. It's always, this married woman, and they assume that she'll have some sort of extra special knowledge because she's been in between the sheets with her husband for whatever. It's not quite the case, but...
Right.
Gatherings around lying in and childbirth are often described as positive female spaces. The birthing room offered opportunities for midwives to ply their trade and neighbors and relatives to support their loved ones physically and emotionally during lying in and labor. Of course, it sometimes was like this, but only when the birthing woman was a femme couvert. When laboring women were unmarried and therefore supposed to be virgins, midwives and other attendees at birth coerced laboring women into naming the fathers of their illegitimate children.
Perhaps the birthing room can be both at the same time, a place of tender, neighborly homosociality with the potential for conflict and coercion. The same can be said of city streets, which were also the domain of married women. It was on the doorstep in the streets that married women lived their lives, gathering to gossip, aid neighbors, and mediate conflict. Married women took the lead in policing their own communities based on agreed-upon social norms. This role had the potential to be divisive just as often as it was...
You don't say divisive?
No, I say divisive.
That's not a word. Divisive?
Yeah.
It is.
I say divisive.
It's divisive.
Well,
but okay.
Divisive is a perfectly acceptable pronunciation of that word.
Okay.
This role had the potential to be divisive just as often as it was community building.
Wow, I learned something new about you today.
Mm-hmm. You did.
Divisive? I've never heard anyone say divisive.
It's fancier when you say divisive.
Okay.
It just proves that I'm fancier
than
you
are. Oh, you are fancy. Anyway, though the homosocial bonds created in the birthing room and on the city streets were meant largely to be enjoyed by married women only, homosocial bonds were also common among unmarried women. Femme soul, who enjoyed all the legal advantages that married women were deprived of, tended to stick together, but out of necessity. Single women often needed to live together to stave off insolvency, so they were often just so incredibly poor that they couldn't live without each other. Widowhood was one avenue to this position. Never marrying in the first place was also a common practice, even though all women were theoretically destined to become married.
Unmarried womanhood in modern America is often touted as a triumph of feminism over the patriarchal order. But early modern women were the OG feminists because as many as 25% of early modern Europeans never married. But ultimately, remaining unmarried in a patriarchal world left early modern women vulnerable to rape, poverty, and accusations of deviance, like witch hunts, right? Like there was exactly. Tons and tons of those. So despite the many disadvantages of life as a femme couvert, many of them were in good shape. Marriage was an exclusive club, one that offered the possibility of financial and social stability that was denied to many.
Right. So we're sort of thinking, like, why would you choose to get married then? Why wouldn't you just cohabitate with someone or something if being married would have all these disadvantages? Mm-hmm. But this sort of secret cast of married, not secret, but this sort of cast of married women, mm-hmm. that's one of the reasons. They held a sort of higher position in society. Now, this prologue of sorts is for Sarah, because I can tell she's just going to explode if she can't talk about the 19th century U.S.
Basically.
Yeah, basically, life. She has to. So as we described in this episode, coverture was interpreted and applied differently throughout time and space, but its existence remained unchallenged for centuries. The doctrine was imported wholesale to the American colonies and remained intact in the fledgling United States of America.
This is until 1839 in Mississippi, when the doctrine of coverture was systematically dismantled over the following four decades at the state legislative level because it became a key issue in American women's fight for suffrage. The Married Women's Property Act of 1839. As American history tends to be, this law's history is fraught with race problems. But here's a quick preview. Maybe
we should do an episode on this one.
Yeah, maybe we could do a whole episode on just this.
Yeah.
So a woman named Betsy Love, who was a Chickasaw Indian, challenged the doctrine of coverture on the grounds that American Indian women should not be subject to Anglo marriage laws. She won her suit and was able to keep her property despite being married. It's worth noting that the property she wanted to keep was an enslaved woman. Mississippi legislators and white women activists worked to pass the Married Women's Property Act almost in retaliation. They argued that if American Indian women were allowed to defend their property rights in court, then white women should be able to also.
Right. It's super, super problematic for a million different reasons.
Those 19th century white feminists were something else.
They were something else. So this is one time in history when something actually happened in America first. And I constantly make fun of Sarah because she'll say, oh, this is the first time this ever happened.
This
and
I'm came like, out of the 19th century.
Except for 300 years ago when it happened in London.
Yeah, but nobody cares about that.
Yeah, everybody cares about it. But coverture was not challenged in courts in the United Kingdom until the 1870s, 1880s. And 1890s with a series of Married Women Property Acts. I'm not exactly sure what this means, but I find it interesting that coverture was dismantled by laws regarding property when coverture affected all aspects of women's life, not just property ownership. So we've talked about like their liability for crimes and inability to get sued, or you know, there's lots of different things that coverture effects, but by the 19th century, the only part that really mattered was the property law.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the reason for this is that by the late 19th century, only the parts of coverture that involved property ownership were being enforced anymore. So even though coverture still existed, like as much as it ever existed, because it kind of never existed because it's common law and it's kind of a fiction, but it existed just as much as it ever had, but only the bits about property were singled out by women's rights activists in the 19th century. So it's arguable that these white feminists who I think it was one particular white feminist, I can't remember her name or her husband's name, but she was married to like a state councilman or something in Mississippi, and he's the one who passed the laws that white women didn't have to follow coverture. And it was at his wife's urging because she was like, wait, this American Indian woman doesn't have to do it. I shouldn't have to do it either. So it's weird that, like, weird race wars in America are the reason that coverture stopped everywhere.
That is interesting.
I know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very weird.
Yeah, very weird.
And you love it because it just vindicates you. And makes you feel like 19th century America is where it's at.
It's interesting, too, that it was, you know, you think about that kind of like a quote-unquote progressive kind of law, right? Giving women the right to property as being sort of progressive, happening in Mississippi and happening so that this woman could keep a slave, right?
So she could keep a slave,
It's this progressive sort of thing. Like, we're getting more and more freedoms, but it's actually giving women the freedoms that they're getting is to take freedom away from other people, which just has America written all over
it,
right?
It's just totally so American. It's unreal. So yeah. And then once the, English women saw these kind of women's property acts being passed in state legislatures in the United States, they were like, wait a minute, like we're, you know, behind the ball on this. And it took them 40 years to pass similar marriage acts.
Yeah. And it's interesting to me too, that, as you said, the other aspects of coverture sort of fall away. And it's the property that remains, and that's what they're kind of fighting for in the 19th century, right?
Right, yeah.
Except for, we mentioned very early in the episode, rape.
Yes.
Right? The idea of marital rape. I can't remember. It seems like it was just recently in the news, but there are still people who don't believe that you can be raped in marriage.
Right.
And like I said at the beginning, I will never stop thinking that it is horrifying that marital rape was not a thing. It didn't exist in New York State until the 1970s.
Yeah, right.
So in that aspect, coverture lasted a super long time.
Right, the social aspects of coverture, yeah. But I guess the most striking part is that women not being accountable to their crimes, just like somebody who is mentally ill or developmentally delayed or whatever, that part fell by the wayside real early on.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's kind of one of the most interesting parts of, like, the 18th century to me, is that was, like, the pinnacle. That's when people were getting off on crimes for this reason.
Yeah.
And it's just amazing. I mean, it's just because, I don't know, to me, the 18th century seems really similar to the society we live in now compared to medieval England or something. Mm-hmm, it's obviously all relative. But I just think to myself, like, I could have murdered someone and just been like, oh, I'm a married woman. And then they'd say, okay.
Yeah,
you're good to go. Like, it's just...
it's wild.
Yeah. And it just infantilizes women. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of offensive to think about like that because they're treated like children.
Right.
But in real life, everybody knew women weren't like children.
Right.
In real life, women ran the show. So, like, what, you know, it's a very interesting dynamic it must have been.
And it's another example of laws that work against women that are specifically created to, you know, control women, but also sort of working in women's favor.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And them knowing that and being able to sort of work within that, whether it's to get away with murder or to create these kind of networks of friendships and power structures that they had within kind of their worlds.
Right.
Which women continue to do, you know,
now,
in the United States, in the 19th century, sorry.
Right. And now.
Yes. Yeah, for sure.
No, it's true. It's an interesting thing.
Yeah.
So I think that's all we have for you today.
Yeah.
Remember, this is the second of four episodes in our law series. So stay tuned for the next episode in our law series on the Nuremberg Laws in Nazi Germany.
Mm-hmm.
It's super fascinating.
Really
and,
fascinating.
Keep in mind, you can listen to these episodes just as a one-off. You don't have to listen to them all, but if you listen to the thematic episodes together, it can kind of tie some things together for you over time and space. It's kind of interesting.
Definitely. They work together in a way.
Yeah.
But you don't have to listen to them that way. You can listen to them however your little heart desires.
Yeah. Do what you want.
Be free from coverture.
Be free from coverture. Okay, so...
Follow us on social media. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. We are on Instagram. We're on Pinterest.
Uh-huh. Oh, and we have a super secret Treefort Facebook group.
Yes.
And if you want in on that, you can just direct message us on Twitter or email us at hello@digpodcast.org, and we will get you in the back door.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see. No, not the sexual we'll back door.
Get you in the back door.
We'll just give you some backstage access to,
there we go. To the podcast, lives. And we talk about episodes, and we talk about, you know, just whatever.
And we share funny historical memes.
Right. Also, on our website, digpodcast.org, you'll find show notes, transcripts, pictures that go along with every episode. And a lot of times, you'll hear us talking about books that we use or that we recommend. You'll find lists of all of those books there. So if you're interested in buying them or going to the library to borrow them, that all that information is there as well. And we do encourage you to do that because we rely on the work of some really fantastic historians to put these together.
And we want to support them.
Yeah.
Yes. So we'll catch you next time.
Peace out.
Bye.
Bye.
The same can be true. I gotta get Google.
That's racist, Sarah.
Sorry. It's like because I ate now, there's like goobers in my throat. Okay, you're taking a real long time.
Yeah, you are. You're moseying pretty.
I'm moving really
okay,
quiet.
Molasses.
Give me my cup over there.
Molasses, like Melvin.
Okie dokie. The 1563 statue of
artificers.
You just laughed the funniest laugh. It's so cute.
You're so cute. In the 1963... What?
Not 1963.
Oh, no, oh my God.
This is far from 1963.
Super far. So I was like, no way it's 1963. Okay. Oh my God, I said 1963. It's 1632. Okay.
Not like you even
I really can't.
The numbers.
My one eye, my contact just keeps floating, so I maybe that's part of it. I don't know. Oh my God, what the fuck? Okay. No.